readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles.
Seems like we're just settling into our autumn schedule and bam, the holiday season is upon us. Like all of us, I bet you're gearing up for Thanksgiving and beyond. Food, wines, party planning, and perhaps some holiday travel? At this time of year, there's a lot on your plate, but don't panic. As your literary guide, I'm here to help with a great menu of titles on the topic. I'm speaking with two wonderful authors today. Alan Salkin, whose book, From Scratch, is an eye-opening behind-the-scenes look at the Food Network. And travel guru Pauline Frommer, who's ready with tips and tricks to speed you effortlessly through the holidays. We've got an itinerary that's packed incredibly tight. So let's turn now to page one of the book report. A delicious memoir from the author of The Sharper Your Knife, The Less You Cry, Kathleen Flynn's Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good explores the very beginnings of her love affair with food and its connection to home. It is the story of her Midwestern childhood, its memorable home cooks, and the delicious recipes she grew up with. Flynn shares tales of her parents' pizza parlor in San Francisco, recipes for chili made by former Army cook Grandpa Charles, and fluffy Swedish pancakes from Grandma Inez. Through these dishes, Flynn came to understand how meals can be memories and how cooking can be a form of communication. Cassandra Campbell narrates.
"She's dying," my uncle said. "It could be a day, a week, or a month. She's in bad shape. She keeps talking about you, and..." He couldn't go on. Hazel was just 36 years old. Dad turned ashen. "No one told me it was that bad," he said, stunned. He stared blankly at my mother across the room. Without a word, he handed her the phone. He sat on the couch, his head in his hands, still in his police uniform. Bob pulled himself together to talk to Mom.
"It's just a matter of time now. She's been talking about Milt, and she wants to see him. It's..."
His voice broke.
"Her dying wish."
Mom's heart dropped. "We'll get him there, one way or another, just as soon as we can." Then she quickly hung up to avoid costing Bob any more money on the call. Practical people, they talked about the options. Bob had mentioned flying back to Michigan. A flight would cost about $600, equal to $4,670 today, or about 10 times the monthly rent on their house. Plus, they agreed, if he went back for a week, would that be enough? "Maybe we should consider moving back to Michigan," she said gently. "It won't cost any more for all of us to move than it would for you to fly back one time." Dad kept a hard gaze on the floor. "We've got enough money for the trip, and some to hold us over until you find work. It's been a great adventure, but maybe it's time we went home." With that, my parents left California just as quickly as they got there. Dad gave notice the next day. His Irish co-worker, Brendan McGuire, bought some of their furniture and agreed to sell off the rest and send them the proceeds. 2 weeks later, they were on the road. The morning they left, my mother walked through their empty house and into the sunny backyard bedecked in all shades of pink and yellow roses. She went to a climbing bush with fuchsia blooms, took a deep inhale, and stared up at the clear, cloudless March sky. Then she fished into her pocket for a small pair of scissors and snipped off one of the larger roses. After they hooked up with Route 66, this time heading east, they stopped less often now that the kids were older. To avoid their experience with the Route 66 song on their way out,
Mom brought a stack of songbooks with her in the front seat. When the kids got tired and started to fight, she taught them another song. "Kids can't fight when they're singing," she says. One from the Boy Scout songbook became a family favorite. "Oh, Mr. Johnny Verbeck, how could you be so mean? We told you you'd be sorry for inventing that machine. Now all the neighbors' cats and dogs will nevermore be seen, for they'll all be ground to sausages in Johnny Verbeck's machine." Days later, they hit a blizzard in Ohio. Mom reached into the glove compartment, where she'd stashed the fuchsia rose. She cradled the limp flower in her hand for a last smell of California. As they crossed into Michigan, the petals fell apart, scattering in her lap.
That was Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good by Kathleen Flynn. Alan Salkin has been a New York Times staff reporter and has written for several prestigious magazines. Alan attended UC Berkeley, then earned his master's in journalism at NYU. Alan has had a diverse menu of jobs, including casting industrial films in Hong Kong, picking oranges in Crete, and peddling oil paintings door to door in Western Australia. The New York Times Book Review describes his new book, From Scratch, The Uncensored History of the Food Network, as dishy, behind the scenes, and salacious enough to keep you swinging from one good old-fashioned bootstrap story to the next. The book was 3 years in the making, while Salkin conducted more than 200 interviews. It is the definitive account of the 20-year-old network and its stars. Welcome, Alan, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
It's a treat, Elaine.
How did you get interested in the Food Network, and what made you write the book?
Well, the first Food Network star I ever heard of was Emeril Lagasse, whose, you know, show Emeril Live was the big breakthrough for the network in its early years when it was still struggling to survive. But I wasn't really interested in writing about it until I went down to the South Beach Food and Wine Festival in 2008. Now, that is basically the Sundance Film Festival of the food media business. And I was amazed to see people like Mario Batali and Rachel Ray with handlers and bodyguards and agents swirling about. And this was the year that Emeril had sold his businesses to Martha Stewart for $50 million. So all of a sudden it was this world of money and heat and fawning fans. And I wrote a couple small articles for the New York Times about it, about the guy that started the festival, and then other people in this world. And I just realized it was a story that needed to be told. It was really that Food Network's story was the story of how America became so obsessed with food.
So how and when did chefs become rock stars?
There was basically, it was a project that started in the mid-90s, maybe sooner, with a guy named Shep Gordon, not Chef, but Shep, who was literally a rock star's talent manager, Alice Cooper, the glam rocker, or ghoul rocker. And he became friends with Emeril Lagasse and started realizing that there was a way to market chefs just like rock stars or NASCAR drivers. Because they were getting national TV exposure on Food Network, you could attach ancillary products to them, like spices and knives and stuff. And there was just a way to put them in front of the public. Shep used to have chefs cook backstage for rock stars. And he was the one who very consciously created that connection in pop culture.
You know, Emeril was born in Fall River, Massachusetts. Why does everyone think he's from New Orleans?
Yes, he was a very ambitious guy, Emeril, always was, still is. And, you know, he had an opportunity to go to college on a music scholarship. He was a great drum player. His first breakthrough, he went to Johnson & Wales Cooking School in Providence, Rhode Island, not far from Fall River. And coincidentally, it's Johnson & Wales that put the first idea into the local cable company in Providence that a 24-hour food network would be a good idea all the way back in the early 90s. And so Emeril got his first breakthrough job at Commander's Palace in New Orleans. They were just looking for a hot young chef, and they got a recommendation via Johnson & Wales. And so that's where his great restaurants, he went on to found, you know, Emeril's and his own great restaurants down there. And that's the food he's become known for.
And, you know, I enjoyed reading in your book, you pointed out that he said he taught Julia Child how to suck head and pinch tail.
Nice. You know, Julia made a show called Cooking with Master Chefs in the early 90s, even though PBS was thought to be about as far as anybody could go with cooking. Nobody thought the Food Network was a good idea. Very few did, and the investors were only willing to put up a million or so each. It was a very difficult business proposition. So Julia was still very influential, very important to have associated with Food Network. And on Cooking with Master Chefs, she went down and cooked with Emeril, and he showed that he was really good on TV in that. She also cooked in L.A. with Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Fenniger, who went on to become the two hot tamales on Food Network. And Julia also made appearances on the Food Network in the early days. I tell some really pretty funny stories about her love for McDonald's French fries.
You know, I enjoyed reading about Joe Langham. Tell us about him and also what happened to him.
Well, Joe Langham was the executive at the Colony Cable in Providence, Rhode Island, who had this meeting one day in his office. And this was the era in the early 90s when they were going from 30 cable channels, the country was, to what they knew was coming, the 500-channel universe, which obviously has been superseded now by the Internet and everything. So these guys were looking for new ideas for cable networks that they could try on this expanding cable dial. And Joe was not really a foodie. He just liked pizza. In fact, very few of the people associated with Food Network in the early days were foodies, especially on the executive side. They just saw a business proposition here. And so Joe had a meeting with this guy, Ken Levy from Providence Journal. And I tell this whole story about how Joe thought it was a pretty bad idea to put cooking shows on, but he eventually was the one who propelled the idea through his company and really made it happen. And Joe also was the one that had the idea, once Food Network moved to New York, to have Emeril Live, have this cooking show shot in front of a live audience. Joe also realized that having an internet site, a website with recipes could save the network money on sending out recipes via mail, because they were spending hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on stamps. And Joe had all these amazing ideas that made the network happen. But, and I think that's the story of a lot of the book, is how those who were the real creatives, who really were the breakthrough thinkers, eventually kind of got scraps. They kind of got a little small plate of leftovers and sent on their way.
We're speaking with Alan Salkin on The Book Report. Can you share a story about my favorite Anthony Bourdain?
You know, Bourdain is, and he's my favorite in many ways, too, because he's the most literate. You know, as a writer, I have a lot of admiration for him. And he is a great television personality, if not a great chef, and he would tell you that. So my favorite story about him is that he didn't really want to do he had no idea to do a television show. And somebody, after the success of Kitchen Confidential, his first well-known book, producers came to him and had the idea to pitch a show based on his next book, A Cook's Tour, to Food Network. People forget that show was on. That's how he got his start on TV, was on Food Network. And after two seasons of Bourdain basically doing the same show he does now, traveling around the world, eating Cobra Heart, going up the Mekong River, the Food Network came to him and said, you know, that one episode you did where you visited a barbecue joint in the South got better ratings than any of these things you're doing overseas, which are very expensive to produce. So we want you to do more sort of barbecue shows and stay in the U.S. And Bourdain, who had already gotten the Spanish chef Ferran Adrià to agree to do a little show with him about Ferran's process, basically told Food Network, if I can't do it my way, I'm not interested, go to hell. And that's who he is, and he's right. And if you're as brilliant as him, he can get away with it and go on to more success. So he is who he is, and that's the great thing about him. And it comes through on TV with a lot of these people. It's the people who strike a false note do not work on TV. The viewers can tell.
All right. And that's a great segue to Paula Deen. You want to talk about her two-part Crash and Burn?
That's right. It was a two-part Crash and Burn. People think that Paula Deen, you know, got booted off Food Network because she admitted to using the N-word, the racial N-word. But really, it had started a year earlier when Paula, who was, and I also have to say, I think the story of how she got on the network was pretty interesting post 9/11 when they were looking for comfort food kind of personalities. But in the end, about a year before the N-word controversy, she took a few million dollars to endorse a diabetes drug without really telling the Food Network in advance. She just went on the Today Show, said she has diabetes, and she's advocating for this one specific treatment, and you can go on the web and look up her new healthy recipes for, like, plum cake. All of a sudden, this indulgent kind of grandmother figure that viewers had come to know and love, who was famous for telling us to eat more butter and more sugar, watching her show changes from fun to being like watching an alcoholic drink themselves to death. You worry that she's literally killing herself by eating all this sugar. And the Food Network, which was not collecting a percentage on any of her endorsement deals, any of her many endorsement deals for Paula Deen, you know, breakfast, pop-up treats, and mattresses and furniture, was not making enough money off of her. Her ratings were falling. And so by the time this bad PR comes across with the N-word, they had very little left to want to do with her.
What do you think the network's future looks like?
I think they're going to continue to be a, you know, middle-of-the-road cable channel that some people really like and that also suffers from the changes in the cable TV business. People are unplugging cable. It's too damn expensive. And like every other brand, they're trying to figure out how to keep eyeballs, you know, in a day when people are turning to the internet. And you can get recipes in a million other ways, little instructional food videos a million other ways. And every other network has poached its territory with cooking shows. The real question is whether America is still as obsessed with food as it was. This wave happened with great contributions from Food Network, in which everyone has become obsessed with food. And maybe the revolution has happened, and there's another network that's going to become more the sort of central interest of our culture.
So are you already at work on a new book?
I am at work at a few things. I have another book idea about a big major kind of media, you know, enterprise, but I also have a sort of memoir-y crazy book about an American writer in India who died and this sort of real-life mystery I got sucked into. I'm also working on a pilot for a fictional television show, a drama. And so I'm actually overwhelmed, but it's still fun to have all the opportunity that I have to talk about and think about the Food Network.
Oh, well, thank you, Alan. I really enjoyed the book. It's been great speaking with you today.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
Kale, sriracha sauce, Honeycrisp apples, cupcakes. These days, it seems we are constantly discovering a new food that will make us healthier, happier, and somehow even cooler. Superfoods, remember them? Pomegranate seeds and acai berries. What happened to them? Did these foods suddenly cease to be healthy a few years ago? And by the way, what is a superfood again? In The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue, David Sachs uncovers the world of food trends, where they come from, how they grow, and where they end up. Traveling from the South Carolina rice plot of America's premier grain guru to Chicago's gluttonous bacon fest, Sachs, who performs the book, reveals a world of influence, money, and activism that helps decide what goes on your plate.
The earliest cookbook references to cupcakes, or rather, cup cakes, reportedly date back to the late 18th century, though it's likely that miniature cakes, in some form or another, arose around the same time as, well, big cakes. On the Food Timeline, an online resource of food history, they are referred to as cupcakes, Vienna cakes, queen cakes, fairy cakes, and Charlotte Russe, which was a simple sponge cake and cardboard covered in whipped cream. The 20th century saw cupcakes rise to their current form thanks to innovations in food processing technology, which allowed for packaged cake mixes and a rainbow of colored icing options. Months after World War I ended, Hostess launched its plastic-wrapped chocolate cupcake with its iconic loopy spine of white decorative icing, and the corporate cupcake era officially began, bringing them to grocery stores across the country. Betty Crocker and Duncan Hines mixes followed, along with the Easy Bake Oven, making the process so simple that cupcakes were often the first foods children made themselves. For most of the latter half of the 20th century, cupcakes were a North American bakery fixture, along with cookies, brownies, and other sweets occupying space in the display case. They came in vanilla and chocolate and were iced in the same two flavors, though the icing, which could be buttercream, ganache, or some processed variation, rarely amounted to more than 20% of the whole cake. Often they were topped with sprinkles, either chocolate or rainbow, or sometimes those silver-coated sugar ball bearings called dragées that rip through your molars like a diamond drill and are legally considered inedible by the Food and Drug Administration. During the 1970s and 1980s, muffins, not cupcakes, were the star of the bakery business, spurned by the high-fiber diet trend, which was believed to combat heart disease and other ailments. Bran muffins were a fixture atop diner counters and coffee shops everywhere, along with their cohorts blueberry, banana, carrot, and chocolate chip. There were sugar-free muffins and frozen muffins, miniature muffins and giant muffins, muffin mixtures and muffin franchises, including my personal favorite, Muffins, a Toronto bakery chain where the crisp top of the muffin was the size of a portobello mushroom. Every bakery worth their oven was into muffins, and Ann Warren in New York City was no exception. "We actually opened up doing homemade-style donuts," recalled Warren. "But it was really part of the muffin thing when we opened in 1987. Muffins were very, very big. I mean, literally, people were into very large muffins." She made these muffins to sell to other cafes and restaurants. But when a retail space opened up in their Chelsea neighborhood a year later, Warren and her husband figured that selling directly to the public might be an easier way to approach baking. They sold coffee and donuts, muffins, pies, and cakes. And because there was so much cake batter and an abundance of empty muffin pans in the afternoon, they made cupcakes as well. They called the bakery Cupcake Cafe. "We weren't even trying to be a cupcake cafe," said Warren by phone, speaking between baking shifts at the Cupcake Cafe. "We just came up with the name, really, because we like the association between cake and a cup of coffee. Not," she insists, "because they were bullish on cupcakes." As the realization emerged among customers that most muffins, even if they were made with bran and raisins, were in fact no healthier than the stick of butter they were made from, the muffin trend quickly faded. In response, Warren increasingly filled those vacant muffin tins with batter for cupcakes, which she calculated were less of a caloric indulgence than even a bagel and cream cheese. Warren's cupcakes were comforting, pretty affairs, a moist cake base with a thin ganache frosting and a small buttercream flour on top. But they never kicked off any significant uptick in cupcake buying. Sure, she had a steady stream of clients, some of whom bought cupcakes, but people mostly came to Cupcake Cafe for coffee and other baked goods. Cupcakes were popular there, but like most other bakeries, Cupcake Cafe largely sold them to children or for birthday parties. One customer who frequented Cupcake Cafe in the early 90s was the actress Sarah Jessica Parker, who was starring in a Broadway play nearby. "She used to come in, sit at the back table with my daughter and have her coffee," recalls Warren, though she can't specifically remember Parker eating a cupcake. It's easy to imagine Parker sipping her coffee and reading the newspaper as Warren walked by her with a freshly iced tray of cupcakes, neither of them realizing the significance of the moment as the future trend and its tastemaker passed unknown.
That was The Tastemakers by David Sacks. And And as we all lift a toast to the holiday season, let's listen to Proof, the Science of Booze. Adam Rogers has written a spirited narrative on the fascinating art and science of alcohol, sure to inspire cocktail party chats. Drinking gets a lot more interesting when you know what's actually inside your glass. Microbrewed ale, single malt whiskey, or a Napa Cabernet Sauvignon. All of them begin with fermentation, where a fungus called yeast binges on sugar molecules and poops out ethanol. Humans have been drinking the results for 10,000 years. Distillation is a 2,000-year-old technology invented by a woman, a technique we're still perfecting today. And the molecular codes of alcoholic flavors remain a mystery pursued by scientists with high-tech laboratories and serious funding. Alcohol production is really powered by physics, molecular biology, organic chemistry, and a bit of metallurgy. And our taste for these products is a melding of psychology and neurobiology. Proof takes readers from whiskey-making meccas of the Scottish Highlands to the wine labs at UC Davis, and to more than one bar, bringing to life the motley characters and evolving science behind developments in boozy technology. Sean Rennett narrates.
My standard response to a new fruit or flavor is to clarify and see what happens, Arnold says. Gelatin and isinglass are good for removing tannins. Chitosan, made of crustacean shells, and silica can pull solids out of milk. But vegans don't eat chitosan, gelatin, or isinglass. They're all animal products. Arnold would like another option to offer at the bar. Chitosan made from fungal cell walls might get past the vegan barrier, but doesn't clarify as well, he says, and neither does the mineral bentonite. Arnold also uses agar sometimes. It comes from seaweed. I prefer agar clarification to gelatin, he says. There's a flavor difference. Sometimes it's a benefit and sometimes it's a detriment. Depends on the application. The point of all this stuff is to bring to bear the most sophisticated chemistry and lab techniques in the service of one singular, perfect moment. The moment when a bartender places a drink in front of a customer and the customer takes a sip. So, for example, Booker & Dax makes a drink called an Aviator, a riff on a classic pre-Prohibition cocktail, the Aviation. That's gin, lemon, maraschino liqueur, and a bit of creme de violette. Made properly, it has a kind of opalescent light blue hue and an icy citrus prickle. Arnold's version uses clarified grapefruit and lime, and it actually manages to improve on the original in terms of intense gin botanical plus citrus flavors, while remaining water clear. Alcoholic beverages are, in their way, much more complicated than even the most haute of cuisines. This is the kind of insight that drives Booker and Dax, though Arnold doesn't really cop to that. I'm not trying to change the way people drink. I'm trying to change the way we make drinks, he says. I'm not trying to push the customers out of their comfort zone. Quite the opposite, in fact. Arnold says that all of his tinkering and tuning, all the rotary evaporator distillation and chitosan fining, is about pushing people into a comfort zone. He's trying to take a rigorous, scientific approach to creating a perfect drinking moment, every time. That said, while appreciating Arnold's sorcery doesn't require that a customer know the secret to the trick, it helps if the customer at least notices the magic. Sometimes, Arnold acknowledges, if a customer doesn't know anything about what we're doing, it can be problematic. In the early days of Booker and Dax, when Arnold was still working behind the bar every night, a guy came in and ordered a vodka and soda. It's arguably the dumbest mixed drink ever invented. In most bars, the bartender fills a tumbler with ice, pours in a shot of cheap vodka, not from the shelves behind the bar, but from the well beneath it, where the more frequently used house labels are, and then squirts in half-heartedly carbonated water from a plastic gun mounted next to the cash register. Not at Booker and Dax, though. Arnold thought about it for a moment and told the guy he could make one, but it would take 10 minutes. And could the customer please specify exactly how stiff he wanted it? Arnold was going to calculate the dilution factor that would ordinarily come from ice and soda, titrate vodka, and maybe a little clarified lime with still water, and then carbonate the whole thing with the bar CO2 line. It seems like a lot of trouble in the service of an unappreciative palate. Why serve it at all? I ask. Vodka and soda is a crap drink. I think vodka and soda is a crap drink because it's poorly carbonated, Arnold answers. If I can make it to the level of carbonation I like, it won't be crap. I will not serve a cocktail that will make me sad. I push the point. But the customer wants a crummy vodka and soda, with soda from a gun, because that's what he's used to. Look, it's not our place to judge people's taste preferences, but I won't serve you crap. Arnold pauses for a moment, sips at his house carbonated water. I've never had someone not like the better version.
We've just heard Proof, The Science of Booze by Adam Rogers. Maximilian Potter uncovers a fascinating plot to destroy the vines of La Romanée-Conti, Burgundy's finest and most expensive wine, in Shadows in the Vineyard. In January 2010, the famed proprietor of the Domaine de la Romanée-Conti, the tiny storied vineyard that produces the most expensive, exquisite wines in the world, received an anonymous note threatening the destruction of his priceless vines by poison, a crime that in the world of high-end wine is akin to murder, unless he paid a 1 million euro ransom. The proprietor believed it to be a sick joke, but that proved a fatal miscalculation, and the crime shocked this fabled region of France. The sinister story that Vanity Fair journalist Maximilian Potter uncovered would lead to a sting operation by some of France's top detectives, the primary suspect's suicide, and a dramatic investigation. This botanical crime threatened to destroy the fiercely traditional culture surrounding the world's greatest wine. The book, performed by Donald Corin, takes us deep into a captivating world full of fascinating characters, small-town French politics, and a local culture defined by the twin veins of excess and vitality.
Though Monsieur de Villene would have insisted he was unworthy of such a comparison, he had much in common with Monet. When Monet first picked up his brush, he saw and painted the natural world in pieces. He put the water here and the sky there. The field went here. The flowers and trees went here, here, and there. Each was an element unto itself, existing almost independent of its surroundings, as if, just like that, any one of the elements could have just as easily been placed in another scene, transported to another painting. As he matured, however, Monet's work became less technical and more organic, spiritual. He came to understand nature's power. It was as if one day, while standing alone on the banks of that pond covered in water lilies, Monsieur Monet discovered a crease in the universe, pulled it open like curtains, stepped inside, and turned and viewed the world from another dimension, from a perspective that allowed him to see the interconnectedness of it all, to see the light and air, and the flicker and flow of energy among all natural things. It was then that Monet began to make the invisible visible. The lines he had once thought defined and separated some natural order dissolved into a liquefied oneness, filling the canvas for others to drink in, and if only for a few moments, to experience the divine. This was what the Grand Monsieur labored to do, only with grapes. His life had been dedicated to transcending the technical and vinifying nature's invisible energy. As he studied the masterpiece of the landscape around him, the Grand Monsieur prayed for a sign. He prayed, although he wasn't as confident in the power of prayer as he once had been, because of recent horrific events and the possibility of unsettling outcomes, the Grand Monsieur had begun to question God's very existence. You wouldn't have been able to detect his fermenting anxieties just by looking at him, or maybe you could have. If you were among the very few he trusted to know him well enough, and you happened to glimpse him in a moment like this, his long, weathered face and forlorn brown eyes, when he thought no one was looking at him, when he thought he was alone and could be himself. Then again, it had been so long since Monsieur de Villene had known what that was like, a private moment unto himself. There was no himself, only the tangle of what he represented. The vines, the families, the domaine, Burgundy, France, the storied legacy of countless holy men and one unholy prince. A legacy subjected to the currencies of markets too often ignorant of how to truly appreciate a bottle of Burgundy, and that were instead driven by the whims of buyers who were obsessed with the bangs of auction gavels and status symbol trophy bottles. For the longest time, Monsieur de Villene had wanted no parts of any of it. He had resisted. It would be fair to say he had fled Burgundy's vines. But crawling into a blackness that he believed was certain death, riding horseback into the starry night of the American West, repeatedly enduring the heartache of the unborn, well, these things have a way of altering a man. Over time, like the best Pinot Noirs, within the bottle of his skin, Monsieur de Villene's composition had become something other than what it had been. He matured. He came to accept and to appreciate what had always been his destiny, caring for his enfant vines and producing the most magnificent and most misunderstood wine in the world.
We just heard a sampling of Shadows in the Vineyard by Maximilian Potter. Holiday time is just ahead. I know many of you will be traveling, whether home to see the folks or taking the family away on a vacation. The Book Report is thrilled to have travel expert Pauline Frommer with us. Along with her famous dad, Arthur Frommer, Pauline hosts a nationally syndicated radio show on travel. She's the author of the 2014 Frommer's Easy Guide to New York City. Pauline regularly provides travel advice on national TV and radio and has appeared on 2020, The Today Show, The Early Show, the CBS Evening News, CNN, Fox, and so much more. Today we'll be learning some incredibly useful travel tips from the expert. Welcome, Pauline, and thanks for joining us on The Book Report.
My pleasure. Lovely to speak about books.
For holiday 2014, what are some of your favorite destinations?
Oh, gosh. Well, the problem with holiday travel to most anywhere in the world is you have expats going home. So we know that the most popular destinations in the United States are New York City, Orlando, and Las Vegas. And it used to be that Las Vegas would empty out around the Christmas holidays. That has changed. People are going there year-round nowadays. It's also become a very big music destination. Lots of people heading there for music festivals, which is a very interesting fact that has lowered the demographic significantly. You're getting a lot of young people going to Las Vegas.
Is it an urban legend that Tuesday is the best day to book air tickets?
It wasn't 2 years ago. There's a company called the Airline Reporting Corporation, which acts as the middleman between travel agencies and the airlines. And 2 years ago, they put out a study of literally millions of fare transactions, and they showed that on Tuesdays, prices dropped. Well, about 3 weeks ago, they put out a new study, and the date has changed. Nowadays, you pay 19% less if you buy your ticket on Sundays. That is 19% less than Tuesdays or really any other weekday. You want to book on the weekends now, and you want to book 57 days before you travel if you're flying domestically, and 171 days before an international trip. This is based on them crunching the numbers on literally 130 million ticket transactions.
Wow, that's really fabulous information. Do you have any tips about baggage fees? What can we do to reduce those costs?
It's really hard to reduce those costs if you're going to check baggage. There's really no way around it, unfortunately. unless you're a high mileage member of a certain airline, and because of your loyalty, you get those fees waived. For the rest of us, I would suggest doing what my family and I do, which is we do not own a piece of luggage that is larger than a carry-on. This forces us to be disciplined and to pack lightly. I roll the things in my luggage rather than laying them flat, because you can get a lot more in the bag if they're rolled. If you check your luggage, I guess my big advice to you is get travel insurance, because bags still do get lost. In fact, it's a good idea to get travel insurance in general, because you never know what will happen with a vacation, and it's a big investment. I like those companies that have a really global reach, that have experts all over the world who can help you find an English language doctor should you get sick, or help you replace stuff in a lost bag. Companies like AllianzTravelInsurance.com, that's one of the good ones, because they have so many people all over the world.
How can a traveler save money on hotel reservations?
Well, there's a couple of ways. If you're going to a really highly trafficked destination where there's fierce competition between the hoteliers, I suggest getting a reservation that can be canceled. Because what happens is, in most destinations and places like Cancun, New York, L.A., hoteliers get nervous as the date comes closer, and they start offering discounts that they're not going to offer several weeks out. So if you have a reservation that you can cancel, you can really take advantage of their last-minute panic. Also, in those destinations, sometimes you'll save money by booking an air hotel package. This also has to do with the competition between the different hotels. If a hotel can hide what it's actually charging in a package deal, you're more likely to get a good deal. We once did a book on Cancun, and we found that the average couple saved $500 for a week in Cancun if they booked a package over booking those two elements, airfare and hotel, independently.
We're speaking with Pauline Frommer on The Book Report. Is there any way to do the Big Apple economically at holiday time?
At holiday time? Well, do you have a relative whose floor you can sleep on? Unfortunately, it's very expensive to go to New York City, and one of the cheapest ways to do it is illegal. Airbnb, any rentals for less than 30 days are illegal in New York. That's how people used to save money. Now, you can rent a room from a local, and that is a very good way to save money. You give up some privacy, but you might make a new friend. We have some good religious hotels, believe it or not, like the Leo House, which is for Catholics. There's one called the House of the Redeemer, where you can rent a really, really nice room in a mansion that's right off Fifth Avenue in one of the most expensive areas of New York City for half of what you'd pay in regular hotels. But in these hotels, there are some restrictions. For example, if you're traveling with somebody of the opposite sex who you're not married to, they won't let you share a room. But if you're willing to put up with those things, there are ways to save. I have a book out called The Frommer's Easy Guide to New York City, which gives you these tips. The final way to save: stay in an outer borough rather than in Manhattan. You'll shave off a third of your hotel costs that way.
Back to one of your comments, there actually are websites where you can find out about renting a room in a private home?
Sure. They have names like Wimdu, W-I-M-D-U, like Airbnb, which is A-I-R-B and the letter N and B.com. You know, this is how B&B started, with average Joes renting rooms in their apartments. I've done it personally all over the world because I get tired. I travel so much. I get tired of staying in impersonal hotels, and I've never had a bad experience with it. I think it's because these sites have you write reviews of the hosts, and the hosts also write reviews of the guests.
Huh.
So you kind of know what you're getting into. And also, the money that you pay is not released until after the first night of your stay. So if something goes wrong, you can make sure that you don't have to pay for that stay.
Which do you prefer when you're looking for a hotel? Should you go to a website like Kayak, which has many different hotels, or do you do better going to the individual website of a chain of hotels? Where's the better bargains?
Neither, actually. There are sites that do not sell travel, but simply Google travel information. They have names like Momondo, DoHop, Hipmunk. Actually, Kayak is one of them. And on those sites, you'll often find listed both the prices that you'll get through online travel agencies and also the prices that you'll get from the hotel chains directly. And so that's a really good way to have a very broad search quickly and easily.
Those of us of a certain age used Europe on $10 a day as our Bible when backpacking. What kind of budget should a kid plan for in Europe these days?
Well, you said a kid. You know, believe it or not, you could still do it for $10 a day. If you're a young person who's willing to stay on couches, there are sites like couchsurfing.com, like globalfreeloaders.org, which allow people to stay for free in homes around the world. And there's all kinds of other sharing things that are happening. It's been a delight speaking with you. Don't be frightened of traveling. It doesn't have to be that expensive.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Pauline. Granted, not many of us are rushing to book this trip just now, but Midnight in Siberia, a train journey into the heart of Russia, written and performed by David Green, is one of the most delightful travel titles out this season. After 2.5 years as NPR's Moscow bureau chief, David Green traveled by rail from Moscow to the Pacific port of Vladivostok. Through the stories of fellow travelers, Green explores the challenges and opportunities facing the new Russia.
We approach one window with just one customer, a woman in a sleek black overcoat. In my imagination, an employee of one of Moscow's posh law firms or energy companies, yelling at the top of her lungs at the agent on the other side of the glass. She steps aside, stewing, clearing a path for us. Deep breaths, deep breaths. Здравствуйте, Sergei says to the ticket agent, who just stares back. She has cropped hair that's dyed a color popular among many Russian women. It's an unnatural red, slightly less orange than a carrot, and clashing dramatically with her apple-red Russian Railways vest. Her name tag identifies her as Anna Nikitinka. I see Anna's mouth move, and I'm fairly certain I hear something, but it's barely audible. There's a speaker on our side and a microphone on Anna's, but the system is not accomplishing much. Sergei yells the details of the tickets we want. Third-class tickets in a few days from Yaroslavl to Nizhny Novgorod, then a few days later to Izhevsk. This seems to have done something productive because Anna begins slamming keys on her keyboard, something totally inaudible. Sergei, что? What? Anna, something totally inaudible. Sergei, David, she wants to know if we want insurance. Me, for what? Sergei, I don't know, and it would be confusing to ask. Okay, no. Anna, something that sounds vaguely like splum to me. Sergei, что? Anna, inaudible. Sergei, bed sheets? Me, yes, please. Sergei, да-да. Sailboats, seashells. Anna, 3,590 рубли. Me, 3,590 rubles. I understood that. Sergei, nice. Got the money? We pay. It's around $120 total for 2 third-class seats on these legs of our journey. And we receive beautifully printed pink tickets with the gold seal of the Russian Railways, the reward for all of our troubles. As we walk away, the woman in black returns to the window and she begins screaming at Anna. Misery loves company, and just for fun, I decide to linger. Sergei translates what the woman in black is yelling at Anna about. You didn't tell me when you sold me this ticket that I was in an upper berth. Do I look 20 years old? I have high blood pressure. I can't travel like that. Sergey explains that this outburst is likely more about status than this woman's health. To many Russian travelers, third class alone isn't quite as low as it gets. Third class with an upper berth is rock bottom. It brings the indignity of having to climb up like a monkey anytime you want to reach your sleeping space. To Russians, it's like being spotted driving a bad car. David, a Russian may work in agriculture and have a job digging mud, Sergey tells me as we both lean against a wall near the ticket counters. But if it makes him enough money to buy a fancy car he's happy to boast about, so be it. It's not about what business you're in. It's about whether the business makes you the money you need to drive the car around. Status is everything. It's a reality that often becomes comical. I recall once marveling at it inside a wine bar in Austria. Rose and I were on vacation there and told the bartender we were living in Russia. He told us that he had just had a table full of Russian businessmen who asked for his most expensive bottle of Austrian wine.
We've just heard Midnight in Siberia by David Green. In Delancey, a man, a woman, a restaurant, a marriage, the best-selling author of A Homemade Life recounts how opening a restaurant sparked a crisis in her young marriage. When Molly Weisenberg married Brandon Pettit, he had a handful of offbeat interests. Espresso machines, wooden boats, violin building, and ice cream making. So when Brandon decided to open a pizza parlor, Molly was supportive. The idea was so far-fetched, she didn't think he'd follow through. Before she knew it, he'd signed a lease on a space. The restaurant, Delancey, was going to be a reality, and all of Molly's assumptions about her marriage were about to change. Together, they built Delancey, gutting and renovating the space on a cobbled-together budget, developing a menu, hiring staff, and passing inspections. Delancey became a success, and Molly tried to convince herself she was happy in their new life. Until she realized she hadn't been honest with herself or Brandon. With 20 new recipes for the kind of simple, delicious food that chefs eat at home, Delancey is a moving and honest account of two young people learning to give in and let go in order to grow together. Carolyn Schaefer narrates.
If you want to get Brandon's family talking, you need only ask about his childhood tantrums. And they're off. Their descriptions are sufficiently vivid that you'd think he'd had a screaming meltdown in the family car last week. But if you ask Brandon about his tantrums, he'll tell you that he was constantly hungry and that low blood sugar will bring out the wailing, shrieking lunatic in anyone. When he was 8 or 9, he taught himself to cope by cooking. And his parents, who weren't especially interested in cooking, rewarded his initiative, because in the Pettit household of Upper Saddle River, New Jersey, whoever cooked dinner didn't have to do the cleanup afterward. Anyway, while most of his peers were off wrestling in the yard, breaking things, or lighting household pets on fire, Brandon got a lot of positive attention for cooking. His uncle Tom offered to teach him how to make a few dishes, and so did his mother's friend Ellen. His best friend Steve's mother, Laura, taught him how to make penne a la vodka when he was in middle school. Afterward, before he went home, she dumped out a small Poland Spring water bottle, refilled it with vodka, and gave it to him so that he could make the recipe for his parents. His mother found it in his backpack later that night, and you know how that story goes. Meanwhile, I grew up 1,500 miles to the west in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, the only child in a family so preoccupied with cooking and eating that we would regularly spend dinner discussing what we might eat the following night. My parents met in Baltimore and courted over oysters and pan-fried shad roe, and though they had lived in the land of waving wheat and chicken-fried steak since a few years before I was born, they took pleasure in introducing me to lobster, croissants, and Dover sole. My father was a radiation oncologist, and he worked full-time until he was nearly 70, but most evenings after pouring himself a scotch and thumbing absent-mindedly through the mail, he made dinner. It wasn't necessarily fancy. There were hamburgers and salad and cans of baked beans, and his macaroni and cheese involved a brick of Velveeta, but the kitchen was where he went to relax, to unwind from a day of seeing patients. He was a good cook. My mother is also a good cook, a very good cook, but I think of her mostly as a baker. She made brownies and crisps and birthday cakes, and in our neighborhood she became something of a legend for the elaborate cookies and candy she made each Christmas. Food was how the three of us spent time together. Cooking and eating gave our days their rhythm and consistency, and the kitchen was where everything happened. As a baby, I played on the floor with pots and spoons while my mother cooked. The three of us sat down to dinner at the kitchen table nearly every night, except Thursdays, when my parents went out and left me with a Stouffer's turkey tetrazzini and Julia Beale, the elderly babysitter who always arrived with a floral-patterned plastic bonnet tied under her chin. And we kept up the habit, minus Stouffer's and Mrs. Beale after a certain point, until I went to college. I started cooking with my parents when I was in high school. I was not what you would call a difficult teen. Friday night might find me baking a cake or holed up in my bedroom with my notebook of poems. If I felt like doing something really exciting, I might invite some friends over and make a rhubarb cobbler. When I was 17, Food Network came into existence, and then I spent hour after hour watching cooking shows, which fueled even more baking, and a poem about immersing myself in a vat of marshmallow fluff.
We have just heard Delancey by Molly Weisenberg. Jim Gaffigan ponders this question in his hilarious new book, Food, A Love Story. What are my qualifications to write this book? None, really. So why should you read it? Here's why. I'm a little fat. If a thin guy were to write about the love of food and eating, I'd highly recommend that you do not read his book. Bacon, McDonald's, Cinnabon, Hot Pockets, kale. Stand-up comedian and author Jim Gaffigan has made his career rhapsodizing over the most treasured dishes of the American diet. For example, quote, choking on bacon is like getting murdered by your lover, unquote. If you found his bestseller, Dad is Fat, Laugh Out Loud Funny, you'll find this title, performed by Jim, sinfully delicious.
Wait. Sometimes I catch myself telling total strangers that my belly is not real, that I actually had to get stomach implants to ward off female suitors. This strategy generally fails because I've caught women staring at my gut. I usually point to my eyes and say in a very condescending tone, "Hello, I'm up here. After all, I'm not some piece of flab for anyone to oogle at." Once after a show, a woman told me, "You're not that fat," like it was a compliment. I held myself back from answering her, "You're not that polite." I'm not sure how overweight I am, because you're supposed to find out this information by calculating your BMI. Once I found out that did not stand for Big Mac included, I stopped trying. There was a time when I was thin. Sure, I was 6 years old, but I'm confident I can get back into those clothes. Actually, around the age of 7, it became very obvious that I had the body type of someone who would have to work out twice a day just to look out of shape. I struggled through my 20s and 30s, and then one day I looked in the mirror, saw my belly, and said, "I give up. It's all over." It wasn't defeat as much as acceptance. I figured, I got a hot wife. If she leaves me for getting fat, that means she's shallow. "Honey, do you think looks are important?" "No? Good. Now pass the gravy." Around the time I tricked Jeannie into marrying me, I lost a primary motivator for staying thin. Additionally, my career as a comedian was never affected by my waist size. Even my occasional acting roles were as a character actor. Character actor is, of course, entertainment industry code for not attractive. It became clear that being thin was never going to put me in competition with Brad Pitt. By my 30s, I'd auditioned to be Matthew McConaughey's unattractive friend in 3 movies. I didn't get any of those parts because I wasn't cute unattractive enough. The other reasons to be thin just seem downright esoteric. You'll feel better and have more energy. Next. You'll live longer. Next. Then the reasons just get silly. There's an old Weight Watchers saying, "Nothing tastes as good as thin feels." I, for one, can think of 1,000 things that taste better than thin feels. Many of them are two-word phrases that end with cheese. Cheddar cheese, blue cheese, grilled cheese. Even unsalted French fries taste better than thin feels. Ever eat fries without salt on them? I always think these could use some salt, but that would mean I'd have to get up and move. I guess I'll just imagine there's salt on them. Eating fries without salt on them feels like a sacrifice. What am I, a pioneer? When I have to eat unsalted fries, I often feel like I should be a contestant on Survivor or something. I look forward to telling Survivor executive producer Mark Burnett, "Well, once I had fries without salt on them, so I could probably live anywhere." I realize weight is a serious issue in America, but I also believe some people should be fat. We all have that friend who has lost tons of weight, and whenever you see them, you secretly think, "You looked better fat. Go back to being fat. You're thin, but you look exhausted. Even looking at you makes me want to sit down." Obviously, losing any amount of weight is an accomplishment. Obesity is a big problem in our society. This is a well-known fact. Another fact is there seems to be a general insensitivity to our obese fellow citizens. It seems once a week there's a news segment on American obesity. They always show some big person walking. They don't show their face, but that person has to know that's them. They are probably just sitting at home watching TV. "Well, that sure looks familiar. Oh, crap. Looks like I can't wear that again." That poor guy probably gets to work and is greeted by a coworker. "Hey, Fred, saw your fat ass on the 6 o'clock news." Now it seems like obesity is an industry. At this point, the countless number of documentaries on obesity just makes me hungry. I feel like the insensitivity toward obesity reached its peak with the television show The Biggest Loser. The show seems to be an elaborate insult masked by stories of inspiration. The following is what I think occurred in the meeting when the show was pitched. Producer: "Hey, I got an idea for a show. We get really, really fat people to lose weight, and everyone watches them struggle and fail." Network executive: "That's good. I'm laughing already." So wait. "So we make these really, really fat people run around, jump up and down, more or less torturing them."
"Funny. We get to abuse them. Love it."
"Just thin people get to yell at the fat people, right?"
Of course."
"So there will be these thin, attractive judges, and we'll have the fat people weigh in on national television."
We have just heard Food, A Love Story by Jim Gaffigan. Readers, a great book is the perfect antidote to the holiday frenzy that begins to rain down upon us at this time of year. I'm ready with a complete smorgasbord of new suggestions. Just check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.